So, good afternoon. The rains have come. The last couple of days, sitting with clients, not infrequently somebody will come in and they'll say, you know, I have things to talk about, but it's really fairly small potatoes compared to what's going on down in Texas. You know, so we'll talk about that a little bit. Or maybe a lot. There's a Japanese practice. The Pure Land Buddhists do this practice. It's called Nikon. Nikon means inner seeing. The Pure Land Buddhists are a particular subset of Japanese Buddhism. Their devotion is to Amitabha Buddha, who's the Buddha of celestial light, infinite light. And in this particular practice, you ask yourself three questions. And the first question is, by whom have I been gifted? From whom have I received something today? And second question is, whom have I gifted? To whom have I given something? And the third question is, for whom have I made life more difficult? For whom have I caused problems? It's kind of a fourth step, fearless in searching moral inventory. Out of the 12-step world. So, you know, if you have been plucked off the roof of your home by a helicopter, you have really received something today. If someone has brought their boat down to Houston or Port Arthur or Beaumont or Corpus Christi and has found a way to bring you to safety, you've really received something. I found myself thinking about my experience of being asked to go down and work with chaplains and folks in Baton Rouge following Katrina. I actually have a piece in my book about this, and when I look back over it this afternoon, I thought, oh, actually, I've forgotten a lot of these details. You know, it's been that long ago. I'll read you just a little bit. So I was asked to come to Baton Rouge to work with chaplains and social workers providing care to the first responders working in a group of hospitals run by Franciscan sisters. Flying into Baton Rouge a week after the hurricane, I met an Hasidic rabbi from the New York City office of the chief medical examiner. He had come to help identify unclaimed bodies in the mortuary. This man had seen a lot of suffering in his life, and he knew something about helping people pick up the pieces in the aftermath of devastation. The population of Baton Rouge had doubled overnight, and needless to say, there were no hotel rooms available anywhere nearby. Some of the hospital staff told me they had as many as 20 or 30 people staying in their homes. I slept on a couch in an empty doctor's office. For days, persons fleeing New Orleans had slept under the ramps of Louisiana State University's Pete Maravich Assembly Center, which served as the largest field hospital for acute care injuries ever created in United States history. In 8 days, the emergency rooms of the Franciscan hospitals alone had seen over 3,000 people, and there were 3,000 homeless pets in the LSU Agricultural Center. The blue hospital signs on the interstate, the first ones north of New Orleans, pointed the way to these Franciscan hospitals. People fleeing New Orleans had found an exit from hell. And though their suffering didn't end when they found a hospital, they did find kindness. What responders told me they universally received from those who came for assistance was gratitude beyond words. Y'all treating us like we're human was the refrain these helpers heard over and over. One social worker told me she had never before seen so much physical trauma. That after a few days she went numb to the spectrum of suffering she witnessed, from the horrific to the frustrating. A nurse who had worked for over 48 hours without sleep said her own grief broke through while she was bathing an old man. He had been taken off a bus of nursing home patients, one of whom had died during the trip out of New Orleans. While she was sponge bathing the old man, he softly patted her hand, offering her both comfort and gratitude for her care. An act of kindness from this vulnerable old man just broke her wide open. So there's more. So I want to talk about rescue and recovery this afternoon. There's a picture on the New York Times website. It's of a particular woman. Her name is Susie Williams. And she's a volunteer from Memphis down in Houston. And she's sitting in a temporary shelter in Houston. And around her is just a sea of cots. And she's sitting there and she is an absolute angel of mercy. You can see it on her face. You can feel it in her body posture. And amidst this sea of suffering, she is just a beacon of equanimity. I encourage you to go on the, kind of most posted pictures on that website and find Susie Williams. I don't watch TV very much. When I watch anything, I usually watch Apple TV, something on Netflix. But I was working out in the gym, and I happened to, just in front of my rowing machine, there was a television. And I just found myself so moved and touched by the compassion in action of first responders and volunteers. I know a number of us have seen the movie Dunkirk. There's a moment in the movie in which there's just this flotilla of boats that are coming from the coast of England over to France to rescue the entrapped British and French armies, what's left of them there. And it's such an uplifting moment to see these people who are moved to put their own lives in danger to rescue these imperiled troops. And I had a little bit of that feeling seeing the Coast Guard folks who were flying their helicopters and all the folks who were engaging in actions of compassion down there. Compassion just naturally arises in the face of suffering, doesn't it? Compassion is one of the facets of our true nature. It's who we really are. So whether we're moved to go down there or send money down there or make a call to a friend down there or make contact in some way, that's our natural compassionate nature arising. So there's a lot of rescue going on now, and that will continue on. And then there will be a shift into a period of recovery. And I was thinking about just how long recovery takes. You know yourself just from recovering from an injury to your body. Doesn't it usually take longer than you think it's going to take? Or to an injury to your soul, to your psyche. In my experience, it never happens that, I thought that went more quickly than I thought it would. I was thinking this afternoon that maybe for me the right word is not recovery, as though you could bring back what you had lost. I mean, these people with their homes flooded, they will not bring back what they have lost. So maybe the right word is not recovery, but maybe it's discovery. That there is finding something that you didn't know before. Maybe it wasn't visible to you. Maybe it wasn't anywhere on the horizon. You didn't think it was possibly a part of your life, and yet through compassionate friends and good help and grace itself, there is some discovery of something you didn't know before. You know, we take for granted food and shelter and clothing. But if you're in Texas right now, you are not taking for granted food and shelter and clothing. So Nikon, I would suggest, is a great practice for you, not just now, but as I have been doing this practice, you know, I wake up in the morning and I'm just grateful for indoor plumbing. You know, it's like, wow, you know, that wasn't a part of human experience for, you know, for much of the human story. And for the contractors and the architect who build my house. And I look around my office and I see so many things that were given to me. There's a calligraphy from Japan, and my father brought me that from a Zen temple in Japan. And there's a Tibetan thangka which is on the adjoining wall, and my stepson Cecil brought me that from Tibet. And there's a vase which Kathy gave me just months before she died. It's a Native American vase, and she says, when you see this vase, you'll remember me. You'll think of me. There are so many things that we have been gifted with. And this Nikon, you know, this word means inner seeing. So we begin to actually look through the lens of, with what have I been gifted today? It's just amazing. And the list is like that. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And then when you think about, and what have I gifted somebody with? You know, comparatively, you know, it's relatively tiny. But you do think about perhaps the times in which you did gift someone. It was far more of a gift to me to go down to Baton Rouge after Katrina than anything that I gave there. And yet it did lift my own spirits to be able to offer what it was that I had to give. We all know that. We all know what it's like to be pulled out of our self-centeredness, our self-preoccupation, and to be able to offer whatever it is that we have to give. When I go to work out at St. Thomas, there's a man named Ricky who runs the free parking in the parking garage, and Ricky always says hi to me and very warmly. I mean, he's working down there in the bowels of this parking garage, and it's hot as hell down there most of the days, or he's either freezing, and he always has this smile for me, you know. And we might stop and talk about the weather or something like that, or I might be in a rush and I might not stop, but he always says hello, and I'm always grateful for Ricky's hello. I had a client this week whose daughter had gone back to college, and when she got back to college in Texas before the hurricane came, she texted him and she said, "Dad, would you send me that ointment that I left in the bathroom? And oh, by the way, would you also send me Mr. Bear? I left Mr. Bear." And Mr. Bear was her stuffed bear that she was given the week after she was born. And it has her birth date embroidered on it. And you know, and this Mr. Bear has just gone with her wherever she has gone for these last 20 or so years. And her dad, in telling me this, said this, that he was so touched. He said, you know, my daughter is really, she's so grown up now. She's so capable, and I'm so proud of her. She goes down as a student nurse. She volunteers in Haiti, and she just loves doing that. He said, and there's also this young, tender part of her that could say, Dad, would you mind sending down Mr. Bear? You know, in psychological lingo, we call these stuffed animals, these blankets, these things like this, transitional objects. It's kind of a bloodless term. But what it's getting at is there are certain things that help us make transitions in life. They help us go from point A to point B. And sometimes, you know, it's like we have a hard time getting across. For little children, transitional objects are a way to give us a vibe of that caregiving presence, that good enough mothering presence, if we have known that in our lives. When my son Alex was about 18 months old, he got himself locked in a bathroom. I think it's just a rite of passage for almost all children to lock themselves in the bathroom at some point. And I wasn't home, but his mom was trying to wedge his what he calls soft blanket between the the floor and the edge of the door, so that he could be able to make contact with that thing, which was going to help him get through this kind of difficult transition. So, you know, think about who the people who have helped you through perilous transitions in your life. I suspect there's not a person in this room who hasn't gone through some perilous transition, if not multiple ones. It might have been just an evening in the emergency room when you were worried about your husband's heart, or something else. It could have been more than just an evening. It could have been a whole season, maybe even years. But someone who, or some ones who held your hand through that. Dad, would you send me Mr. Bear? I've been I was teaching last week over at Montgomery Bell Academy MBA. And you know, it's a bunch of guys over there, and so they're all about autonomy and, you know, being tough and taking care of yourself and all that kind of stuff. But they're also about teamwork over there, about helping each other out, supporting each other. And while, you know, the original research on the stress response, Walter Cannon did this original research, and, you know, what he noticed was this capacity that we as human beings have to fight and to flee and to freeze. The fight-flight part is part of the sympathetic nervous system, but the freeze part is part of the dorsal parasympathetic vagus nerve. And sometimes when we're overwhelmed, we simply just freeze. We simply can't do anything at all. But then there's another part of the stress response, and you've probably heard this. It's called tending and befriending. And I hope this doesn't come across as sounding sexist, but when women typically tend to be better at tending and befriending than men do. But we've all got this capacity in us to tend and befriend. And I think you see a lot of that going on in Texas right now. For men, it is so, I think, hardwired in to say, I've got this, I'm good, you know? It's a real turning point in your life when you're pushed to a position of powerlessness and you have to acknowledge, I ain't got this. And I'm not good. I'm a long way from okay. So we have this ongoing need both to give care It is good for our souls when we give care. And this ongoing need to receive care, we don't ever outgrow it. I remember when my dad was dying in the last couple of weeks of his life, there was this just giant of a man who came to, a giant of a man physically and a giant of a man soul-wise, who came to provide physical care for my dad, to help him get to the bathroom and just to do other forms of care. This man had a backpack, and he had a book of children's Bible stories that he would read whenever my dad was asleep. He knew those stories by heart, but you could tell that this was a way that he centered himself in the caregiving that he was doing. I had lunch on Monday with an old MBA classmate of mine. We hadn't had lunch in 50 years. And he sat down and he went right to the point. He said, "I want to talk about death." You know, that's where you don't usually begin, you know, lunches with that. But I just loved it that he went right there. And he has an illness which is an incurable illness. And he said, "I thought you might know something about this." We talked about our lives, and he had won all the prizes growing up. He won all the academic prizes and all the athletic prizes. And he said, "You know what I've really had to struggle with in my life?" He said, "I've had to struggle with this sense of being unlovable." You know, all this success, you know, the envy of his peers, and yet underneath he had this sense of being unlovable. And the care that he had found when he was vulnerable enough to be able to own that out loud, to go beyond, "I'm good, I've got this." He said that's what had really brought him into a true life. You know, not a pretend life, but a true life. And he has such a heart of compassion. Oh, he has such a heart of compassion. It's a real honor to be with him. I was sitting with another client this week who's going through an extended hurricane in his life. And his way of meeting this, unfortunately for him, is to engage in alternating self-attack and self-defense. And his self-defense programming is very strong. It's an equal and opposite response to his self-attack. And he's just in a place of misery. And it's compounded by self-pity. And resentment of anybody who tries to help him. That would be me. and so we talk about that. You know, his resentment of me and my insufficient attempts to bring him out of his suffering. It's not personal. He's also mad at the 12-step program too, because he's been trying to surrender and trying to surrender and trying to surrender, and it ain't working for him. And I said to him, I said, "It ain't gonna. Your personality, your conditioned self, your small self, your lesser way of knowing is not going to be able to surrender. But your powerlessness, your vulnerability, is actually the key to the lock of surrender. When you can let yourself be that vulnerable, you may find that you can't surrender, but that you can be surrendered. That is to say, you begin to realize that all of your resentment and all of your self-pity and all of your self-hatred and all of your other hatred, all of your defensiveness, these are simply objects in awareness. They've got a big emotional charge, but they are contents in awareness. The awareness itself, like a movie screen, is simply receiving all these contents. It is surrendered to the contents like a movie. This is the movie of your life that is playing right now. But the consciousness, the awareness, the screen that's receiving it is in no way struggling. It's not in contention. It is surrendered. That's where real surrender and real recovery, or my word, discovery, that's where it's to be found. It's not in all of your efforts. It's not in churning and churning and obsessing and blaming. That will not get you there. I know. I've tried that. What will get you there is to discover a you beyond your personality, beyond your conditioning, beyond who you think of as me. And I said to him, I don't know how long it's going to take for the tumblers to click, for the penny to fall for you, but I want you to know I'm not going to give up on you until you find this. Because it is your true nature. It's who you are. It's veiled right now. You don't have any access to it, but it is right here. In this larger open space of true nature, we can ask these three questions of Nikon. We can say, from whom have I received? To whom have I given? And for whom have I made life more difficult? Again, nobody in this room who hadn't made life more difficult for somebody. Somebody's. Okay. Nikon is a practice that invites us to inner seeing of what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. And interbeing is this recognition that we are just so interconnected. You know, when you're waiting for somebody to pluck you off the roof of your house in Houston, you really know how interconnected we are. Right? And again, whether we're suffering or whether someone has brought us flowers to brighten up our bedroom, our hospital room, whatever it might be, we are so interconnected. Here's where you really discover that you are interconnected. When you step back into consciousness, into awareness itself that holds everything, because anything that you know right now, you only know through consciousness. You only hear my voice, you only see my body up here through your consciousness. That's where everything is. Now, when you saw the totality of the eclipse, it was in your consciousness. Your consciousness was perhaps widened by that experience, but that's where it was. Everything together, the all of it, is in your consciousness. The materialist It's a better word. The materialist scientific view is that consciousness arises out of matter. First there was matter, and then some way, we don't really know how it happened, but consciousness was born, right? That's the materialist view. It's, if you will, the scientific view. The panpsychic view is that we have consciousness, and dolphins have consciousness, and bumblebees have consciousness, and earthworms do, and rocks and trees and everything has consciousness. But another, and I think deeper view of the matter, is that everything is consciousness. Consciousness is everything. That's the mystic intuition. The mystics, whether it's Nirsagradatta in Advaita Vedanta, or Ramana Maharshi, or Meister Eckhart in Christianity, or the Kabbalistic teachers, the Sufi teachers, Rumi, whoever it is, they have this intuition. That everything is consciousness. Everything is interconnected. When we wake up to that, there is no separation. And in that moment, compassion naturally arises. In the small self, the lesser knowing, the ordinary way that we walk around, you know, compassion arises sometimes, sometimes maybe not. Sometimes we feel like giving, sometimes we don't. But in this larger awareness, this consciousness that is you, it's nothing but compassion. Nothing but. You are an arising in your consciousness. Your body, your history, your story. All of that is, that's content in consciousness. And you step back from that content. You step back into pure awareness itself. It has no content. It knows itself. In that knowing is loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity, forgiveness. This is the realm of grace. We are not separate from it. It is who we are, and it is who everybody else is too. When we wake up to that, there are no tribes. There are no separations. Sure, we can make distinctions, but there are no separations. This is what the masters have known. The Tibetan masters, the Thai masters, Sri Lankan masters. This is what they know. Last story, I was sitting with a client, and we were meditating a bit, and she said, I've got to stop. She said, I'm panicking. When she actually got quiet, the panic arose. And she said, I've been waking up in the middle of the night with this panic. And she said, it's my response to what's going on in the country right now. And she said, so I have, you know, these Facebook friends, and I put out something. I asked if other people are feeling this too in response to what's going on in the country right now. And she said 80 people responded to her very quickly and said, oh, me too, you know, waking up in the middle of the night or just, you know, out of nowhere, panic seizing me. And she said, and so she asked, what's helping? And she said, to a person, the only response that she got was, well, medication helps. That's a real commentary on American culture. Now, you know, I want to let y'all know, I take medication, so I ain't got anything against medication. You know, you can hold up your pill bottle too and shake it. All right. So this is not a, you know, it's not a slam on medication. But it is to say that in this practice, we have resources. They may not sometimes, as was for me in my depression after Kathy died, sometimes the mindfulness resources are simply not up to the task. But we do have resources to help open us up to this greater way of knowing. I have to tell you that what really helped me after the rescue of electroconvulsive therapy for me in my depression, that was a rescue, pure and simple. That was like being plucked off the roof of a house that was being inundated by a helicopter. But what really helped me in the recovery has been this stepping back into this larger consciousness, which can see these objects of thought, feeling, history, you know, all those things, and step back into this larger, compassionate awareness, which is just holding all that. That's been the real ticket for recovery and discovery. And so that's why I keep ringing this bell of inviting you to step back into this place of pure awareness that knows itself. It may be on any given week or week after week after week, you're saying to yourself, what is he talking about? You know, I don't get this. I just want to say, stay with it. It's the most important thing. And as Suzuki Roshi said, the most important thing is to know the most important thing. Okay. All right. So we'll stop there and share a little silence. So again, let yourself be received, let yourself be held by the surface on which you're sitting. And let your attention go out into the soundscape. Sound of my voice, the subtle other sounds in the room. And then the gaps between sounds. The silence that receives all sound, precedes the sound, is here after the sound. It's a good metaphor for this space of pure awareness. It's endlessly receptive, utterly uncritical. It's the space of loving kindness and compassion. So we always end our practice together with some loving kindness, some compassion. So let's begin with folks in Texas. And you have images in your mind just as I do. maybe a particular image, particular person, a child, a dog, horse, whole group of people. People who are in need of rescue. And we wish for them, may you be free from your suffering. May you be at peace. May you be free from your suffering. All beings want to be free from suffering. May you be at peace. May you find this peace that is already here, even in your suffering. It's what's holding you and your suffering. And we can think of all the first responders, the rescuers, the people who are handing out food and blankets and doing whatever they can to help. May they too be free from suffering, free from overwhelm. And may they access, may they come into the space of peace. The peace that passes all understanding. May they know that peace. And here with our gathering this afternoon, may you and you and you be free from suffering, whatever the suffering is in your life. It's your suffering. However, you're in contention with reality. May you be free from suffering. May you be at peace. May you dwell in peace. Be peace. May our loved ones, those who are dear to us, the ones we hold in our hearts, we carry with us at all times, may they be free from suffering. May they be at peace. May strangers, people who we don't know their names, but they service us, they give us something. May they too be free from suffering and be at peace. And difficult persons too, they give us something in a kind of backwards way. They give us something to practice with. They show us where we're hooked, where we're stuck in the small view. May our difficult persons too be free from suffering. May they too be at peace. And so we wish for all beings. May all beings be free from suffering and be at peace. We dedicate the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of peace and happiness and safety, and to the ending of suffering. So I mentioned last week, there's this wonderful movie about Thich Nhat Hanh that's coming to town called Walk With Me. It's going to be on September 12th, that's a Tuesday, at 7:30 in the evening at the Regal 27, the Hundred Oaks Movie Center. In order to get tickets for this movie, you have to go online, okay? And I've got a little flyer up here in my book bag if you need to... take a look at that link to be able to do that. I think it's really going to be So worth your time to see this. The meditation and inquiry group meets at my home on Sundays, 5 p.m., number 10, Peach Blossom Square. We sit for about 25 minutes, and then we talk about our practice. So thank you for your presence. Thank you for your generosity and the baskets in back and the contribution online. And have a great week. See you next week.